Perfect Killer by Lewis Perdue. Prologue. A moonless black-on-black night shrouded the Mississippi Delta in shades of dark and darker that flattened the feverishly humid world into a two-dimensional caricature. Heard, felt but unseen, mosquitoes boiled out of the killing field's stagnant pools like a biblical plague. In the distance, a scattering of lights glowed beyond a low embankment that kept the Columbus and Greenville Railroad tracks above water, even in flood season. From beyond the embankment came strains of a church hymn drifting from the general direction of Balance Dew, the notoriously impoverished black quarter of Itabena, where raw sewage fermented in open ditches along rutted dirt roads lined with battered wooden shacks. At one with this deepest of nights, Darrell Talmadge squatted in the tall, soggy grass and held his suppressed Colt 45 Model 1911 well out of the swamp water now seeping into his boots. He breathed silently through his mouth. He listened with his whole body, trying to feel his quarry as much as hear him. A freight train rumbled distantly from the east, and from the darkness near the C&G berm came the sounds of a desperate man making his way through mud and tall grass. Talmadge knew all he had to do was be patient. Like hunting deer, he thought. Bag a big buck. The thought made him smile. Talmadge had been a hunting guide in the Delta before the Korean War, before the head wound they'd fixed up so well. They'd saved his life, and for that he did what they asked. That and because he needed the medicine they gave him to keep the visions and the memories away. A sucking sound riveted Talmadge's attention. Over to his left, maybe 25 yards away. Then another, and another. Feet liberating themselves from muck, slowly, cautiously at first, then with a labored acceleration making an angle toward the railroad tracks. Perfect, Talmadge thought to himself. Then Talmadge stood up and in a single fluid moment aimed the Colt. It took only a split second to spot the faintest of shadows, night mottled upon night. He sighted, squeezed the trigger, registered the mild cough of the shot, heard the shriek of pain as the shadow dropped with a wallowing splash.
"Give it up, nigger,"
Talmadge yelled as he crashed through the mud and high grass. Then he picked up the panicked thrashes of a wounded man, stumbling away.
"Shit a brick,"
Talmadge mumbled. This was number 4 in the past 10 days, and he was simply tired of tracking down these boys. Ahead of him, his prey's shadow moved right, reversed course, then sprinted toward the tracks. As the freight rumbled closer, Talmadge knew the boy would rush across the tracks in front of the engine and let the rest of the train shelter his escape, or maybe hop a boxcar. Either way worked for him, Talmadge thought as he swiftly made his way to the edge of the clinker stone at the base of the berm and hunkered down behind a clump of dead grass. He leaned against the slope and aimed the Colt down the berm, steadying it with his left arm. Behind him, the light from the train engine played shadows atop the berm. In moments, Talmadge spotted a shadow maybe 30 yards away detach itself from the brush and start up the slope. In another instant, the locomotive's headlights lit up a wounded man slashed right across his shoulder where the last shot had winged him. Talmadge fired then. He cursed when the slug scattered gravel immediately behind the man's feet. The man scrambled faster. Talmadge felt no anger, no fear, no emotion, no hurry. He kept the aim of his last shot and its trajectory precisely in mind as he corrected his sights for the spot he figured the man would reach when he got to the top of the tracks. Talmadge fired as the train engine blew its horn. The man with the wounded shoulder froze as his face turned toward the train. The slug punched through the man's torso, bent him forward over the nearby track, then fed him to the locomotive's wheel. Perfect Killer, Chapter 1. Monday lay on the land as gray and stone cold as a corpse. Slate clouds, winter-frosted grass, pale headstones, they all sucked the color and the life from the Itabena I had loved as a child. Down the gently sloping field, beyond the rusting iron pickets of the cemetery fence, and across the pitted, often patched asphalt of the access road, the trunks of naked trees waded in the chill, muddy waters of Roebuck Lake. This day promised damn little for the handful of mourners due to gather on this raw January morning to say goodbye to my mother. I stood alone now next to half a dozen folding chairs beside the freshly dug grave. Time-worn astroturf carpeted the ground around it but did little to mask the pile of dirt next to the headstone carrying the name of Mama's second husband. She'd married him only after previously divorcing and marrying my real father 3 times. Go figure. The morning silence gave way infrequently to the occasional car or pickup passing by on Highway 7. A wan breeze brought me faint, episodic snatches of conversation from 2 distant men whose yellow coveralls lent the monochrome day an impressionistic splash of color. I watched them lean against the muddy yellow backhoe 100 yards away, smoking one cigarette after another. When the wind strengthened, it struck my bare forehead like an ice cream headache and slashed through my brand new wool suit, bought just for this occasion. The gust snatched at me with sharp fingers, sent my testicles climbing high and desperate against my groin. I turned my back to the wind and shoved my hands deeper into the pants pockets and felt the icy handprints on my thighs. It reminded me of cold evenings in high school when football practice would run until it was too dark to see the ball. We'd jam our hands right down into our jock straps to keep our fingers limber enough to function and yell loudly for coach, put us in. Because no matter how dead tired you were, it was even worse to stand on the sidelines, have the wind refrigerate the sweat soaking your practice jersey. I looked around. Shit, where the hell was everybody? I turned in a half circle, taking in the deserted little cemetery. As I did, a sudden movement caught my eye over toward a stately magnolia tree's waxy evergreen leaves. I saw nothing now. But convinced somebody lurked nearby the magnolia, I closed my eyes and tried to recall the brief image flashing across the edge of my peripheral vision. Nothing. Didn't see nothing. Shook my head. Had to be stress again, I reasoned as I opened my eyes. Regardless of that, I walked among the dead, headed toward the tree, thinking that even if no one was there, a little walk would get my blood moving, generate some heat. The headstones reminded me how dead people continued to hold us long after they're dead, binding us with memories as strong as love. I studied these things in my work. I tried to tease through the fabric of neurons and the skeins of synapses to determine what makes us conscious, what makes us us. But none of my scientific conclusions mattered now, only sorrow's dark gravity holding my heart in its irresistible orbit. I navigated among the graves of children who died too young and the rusting iron southern crosses of Confederate soldiers who died for no damn good reason. So much sorrow here. Each grave its own epicenter of pain. The loss. Each marker a final punctuation mark for a life story increasingly forgotten. Its memories fading along with those who could remember. Death hurts not just because we face the inevitability of our own death, but also because it opens a hole in our memories, robs us of the warm breathing evidence of who we have been. The loss forces us to redefine ourselves. When I reached the magnolia, I found an old Ford hubcap, cigarette butts, two used condoms, and enough malt liquor cans to verify this as a major after-hours entertainment spot. Life continuing amidst the dead. I walked on and quickly found myself at the southern end of the cemetery next to the Stone family plot. It held the remains of my grandparents, my Uncle William, and my Uncle Wester, whom I had never known, because like so many in the rural South of the 19-teens, he died as an infant from some now treatable disease. The small angel on his headstone, which was intended to imply his innocence, instead looked vaguely sinister to me this morning. The silence was broken now by the low, powerful growl of a truck's exhaust, which drew my attention to the cemetery entrance. I watched as a limousine-sized, four-door, deep metallic gray pickup truck with a matching shell over the full-size bed pulled in and parked behind my rental. Behind the wheel sat Rex, his shaved head gleaming like he had waxed and power-buffed it. He was a young contractor who had occasionally worked at my mother's apartment complex and had taken a liking to her sweetness and anachronistic southern charm. For the past 3 years, he'd looked in on her almost every day, taken special care of her and installed all the special bathroom railings and fixtures needed for a woman whose mobility had been compromised by the years. Rex and his wife Anita, she was a physician at the nearby university medical school, had taken care of Mama and always made sure Miss Annabelle did well. Rex refused to take my money for any of this. He kept me posted on Mama's needs and conditions and helped me secretly funnel funds that she would never take directly because she was determined she would never be, as she would say it, a burden to my children. Rex was a tough man, a few words, and an uncertain past, which may or may not have included warrants connected with murder and mayhem. By the time I met him and learned enough about his past to confuse and concern me, he'd already adopted Mama and she him. Rex waved at me when he got out of his truck and started toward me. He stood a head shorter than me, with a physique like a muscular tank. In his pinstripe, double-breasted suit, he looked like a dapper mafia hitman, and I wondered again whether he was Pack.
Perfect Killer, Chapter 2. I returned Rex's greeting and took a last look at the Stone family plot. My mother had often told me she wanted to be buried here, but her younger brother William had beat her to the last available real estate there. She had really wanted to be buried next to her father, whom she called Daddy and others called the Judge. They called him this even though he had never been elected or appointed to the judiciary, and felt those sorts of public office were not for gentlemen like him. It was, he felt, the duty of true Southern gentlemen like him to anoint those who would stand for election and appointment and who would do his bidding once in office. The success of his theory was attested to by a file cabinet full of personal correspondence from governors and senators and congressmen and lesser public officials and lower mortals, all of them assuring the judge they would do his bidding. Mama had inherited the papers half a century ago, when she'd moved out of her big house into the little apartment across Lakeland Drive from St. Dominic's Hospital in Jackson. She had passed the papers along to me. Out of respect for her, I had not thrown the papers away. But after one slapdash glance through a couple of the hundred or so file boxes, the accreted paper residue of the judge's 40 years of law practice and power brokering, I had stashed them all in mini-storage and all but forgotten about them until now. The judge's elitism, and especially his attitude toward public officials, formed the basis for his everlasting contempt for my father. My father, whose family tree hung heavy with elected officials, including a congressman and a famous U.S. senator, my great-great-grandfather, J.Z. George. George, according to history books, was the first to formalize Jim Crow segregation when he wrote the Mississippi State Constitution in 1890. In it, he embedded the literacy test and the poll tax, two things that disenfranchised half the state's population for the next three quarters of a century. For this, they put my great-great-grandfather in the U.S. Capitol Statuary Hall next to Confederate President Jefferson Davis. I never quite understood the judge's contempt for my family's dark legacy, since it had produced a masterpiece of constitutional handiwork, allowing the judge and all of his other planter friends to keep the black sharecroppers on their plantations in virtual slavery. For all these reasons, and because my father worked for the governor at the time, I scandalized both sides of the family with my expulsion from Ole Miss in the fall of 1967 for leading a civil rights march. The judge disinherited me from his substantial estate faster than you could say scalawag. They were all thankful when I enlisted in the Army, shipped out. I turned away from this past one more time and headed toward Rex. He had called me at my office on Thursday, something he'd never done before. Mama, he said, had gone to the hospital that morning. Like any relatively affluent and extensively insured 87-year-old, Mama had a battalion of medical experts she visited on a regular basis. And on a regular basis, they sent her to the hospital for tests. And likewise regularly, she had her doctors forward copies of her test results to me. She and I would discuss these results extensively. We would have had nothing else to talk about had I not gone to medical school. See, she disapproved of where I lived, how I lived, most of what I believed in, and never failed to complain about my accent and how I sound like a damn Yankee. Of course, my mother was far too genteel to say damn. Southern ladies, in her mind, never used coarse language. From her mouth it came out, like a blank Yankee. And make no mistake about it, Mama was a Southern lady of the very old school, an unreconstructed Delta belle born on a plantation who never understood why happy darkies no longer wanted to stay in their place as God had ordained, like bluebirds not mixing with the sparrows. For this reason, our conversations tended to focus on her medical history. She loved me as only a mother could, but she never understood me or why I had turned out the way I had. Quite frankly, neither had I. Rex and I met now, 100 hours left after his phone call, by a headstone bearing the Stallings name. Hey, Doc. I held out my hand, but instead of shaking it, he stepped closer and gave me a bear hug. I returned it genuinely, but briefly. Hugs from men. Other than my father, who was dead, and my son, who died far too short of being a man, made me uncomfortable. Thanks for coming, I said. I knew it sounded lame even before Rex frowned at me. Nice suit. I tried again. He shrugged and turned to face the gravesite. I tried again. I owe you big time, man, I told him. Rex turned and gave me a curious look. I explained. If you hadn't called me, I'd never have seen her alive again. How's that? Well, after you called me, I phoned Mom at the hospital. She gave me all her usual chatter about how I shouldn't come because my patients surely needed my attention more than she did, and wouldn't it be wonderful if I could take that endowed chair at the University of Mississippi Medical School they had offered me right here in Jackson? Rex smiled. Well, old son, she never stopped talking about that, that's for sure. I shrugged. Well, I just had a feeling this time. I'm glad you called me, Rex. The religious would say it was a divine message, but I think maybe it was more the tone in her voice or simply that she was getting old and my own professional medical judgment told me that the accretion of illnesses would soon overwhelm even her stubborn grip on life. Because of that, I canceled my patient appointments and hospital rounds and grabbed a red-eye from LAX Thursday night. When I got to her room at St. Dominic's Hospital early Friday morning, I sat down with a pale, dry husk of the woman I had seen only months before. It took a moment for her to open her eyes. They were lethargic, flat. They quickly filled with tears when she recognized me. Colon cancer, she told me. Terminal, according to the doctors. She wanted no special measures, no interim surgeries, no chemo. I thought about this as I looked at Rex. I spent the afternoon with her, I told Rex, as we walked toward the gravesite. She was drifting in and out, and a few times she spoke. Her voice was so faint I had to lean over the bed and hold my breath just to hear her. What'd y'all talk about? Rex's voice had an odd tone. Not fear, but not simple curiosity. Well, mostly I read to her from the Bible, I told him. Especially Psalm 121. Over and over. That's all? I nodded, and his usual poker face showed me something like relief. Something like a secret that had not been divulged. And that confounded me, but I put the feeling down to yet one more artifact of stress, like the person who wasn't by that magnolia tree. Yeah, I felt the regret. That was it. When the light from the window got too dim to read by any longer, I told her I needed some sleep because I didn't have any on the red eye from L.A., I kissed her, I gave her a hug, and told her I loved her and that I'd be back in the morning. Rex gave me a knowing look now as if he already knew what I was going to say. Just then, movement interrupted my thoughts. In the distance, a hearse turned into the cemetery off Highway 7 and glided to a dignified stop behind Rex's truck. I turned back to him. Nothing more until the phone call from the hospital at maybe 4:30 in the morning to tell me she was dead. I stopped and looked at Rex closely. They told me she had apparently gotten up to get a cigarette, lost her balance, hit her head, fell down in the darkness. Rex stopped and looked back at me. She died all alone on that cold, hard linoleum floor, I thought. I shook my head as the image tore through my heart one more time. You cannot possibly imagine how many times I've prayed that she had been knocked out by the blow on the way down. I can't stand to think that she ended up on the floor, conscious maybe for a long time, dying all alone in the dark. I wonder if she called for help or simply gave up and closed her eyes and let go. The detail in Rex's eyes gave my stress-worn nerves the impression that he somehow knew the answer to that. And maybe that the answer was that we all die alone in the dark.